Our topic is Turn to Ashes, and the full meaning of that probably won't become apparent till we get to the end of our lesson today. But what we do want to talk about are things that are turned to ashes. And, you know, when you look in the Hebrew scriptures, you find the concept there of sacrificing animals as an integral part of worshiping God. You see it from the beginning of Genesis all the way through to the time of Jesus. Now, the simple and straightforward way of doing it is to build an altar. You put some wood on it, light a fire, slay the animal, and place the animal on the altar to be consumed. Now, the idea here is you want to give something to God. And so the sacrifice then is placed on the altar, and it is consumed, and it rises up to God. You see, this is the upward lifting of it. And so all that's left is ashes behind. Now, in this way, the worshiper demonstrates his desire to gain God's approval by offering to God an animal sacrifice that costs him something. And we'll touch on this idea of a sacrificing costing us something a couple times in our lesson today. And of course, when it's consumed and lifted up to God, we have the idea that we have given God something. Now, in the scriptures, this is called a burnt offering. Certainly, as Bible students, we've studied the tabernacle shadow, so the concept of a burnt offering is a very common one. But just by way of review, what does a burnt offering represent? Now, to begin to build an idea of what it represents, let's go to one of the early offerings that was given. Now, you probably recognize seeing Noah's Ark behind here. You have the family of Noah who have just been delivered through the flood, and they wish now to offer a sacrifice unto God. And they actually offered quite a few sacrifices of the clean animals that were still on board. And in Genesis chapter 8, verses 20 and 21, we read, "And Noah builded an altar unto Jehovah, and took of every clean beast and of every clean bird, and offered a burnt offering on the altar. And Jehovah smelled the sweet savor." Now, let's think about that for a moment. What is so sweet about the smoke coming up from an offering? Now, of course, we could say if you've ever cooked a steak or hamburgers on a grill, you know, that's a pretty nice smell. But is it really the smoke that Jehovah found so wonderful and so beautiful? Is it really that? No, I think as we think about it, we see it's not so much the literal smoke, but rather the heart of those that had something to offer God. That's really what he was delighted in, their obedience in sacrificing something to him. Now, when he gets delighted, that tells us that that's how he's accepted the sacrifice, that it smells sweet to him, that he's delighted with it. Here's a couple of excerpts from the Harvest Message. In Tabernacle Shadows, page 45, the pastor writes, "The burning of the offering on the altar shows how God's accept the sacrifice as a sweet-smelling savor." And again, in reprint 73, "Being burnt on the altar shows how God accepts this as a sweet-smelling savor or perfume." And again, we want to emphasize that it is how God apprehends from the hearts and motives of those that wish to give him something, and he finds a great delight on that. Let's take a detour for just a second, a point of interest here, a connection of interest. I'm going to show you an interlinear of Leviticus chapter 1, verse 10 here, and this is concerning a whole burnt offering. And I want to just focus on one word here. There it is, the whole burnt offering. Now, you might wonder, well, wait a second, this is Leviticus. This doesn't look like Hebrew to me. It's Greek. Well, it is Greek. This is the Septuagint version. But the connection that we have here is with the Greek word. Now, if you look just above that, the Greek word is, and I don't know if you can see my pointer here or not, olokatoma. Olokatoma. Olo sort of sounds like whole, and I'm pretty sure that that's where we get the word from. And katoma you may recognize from another work, a word that we have in English that came from it, caustic. You ever seen something's caustic? That means it burns. So the whole burnt offering. But if you put it together, we have a word that unfortunately it has some very negative connotations, but it comes from this word. And that word is holocaust. The word holocaust means whole burnt offering. It's kind of a shame that it has that association with the horrible things that happened during World War II. But that is the genesis of the word and the derivation. All right, so let's get back to burnt offerings now. While there are many examples in Scripture of various burnt offerings, we're going to focus on one category of burnt offerings today. And that's on the occasions where Jehovah God himself takes the sacrifice by fire. Remember our formula at the beginning, build an altar, put wood on it, light the wood, put the animal on it, and you sacrifice. Well, the piece we're taking out is you lighting the fire. We're going to look at burnt offerings that God himself provided the fire. And you know, just when you think of it off the head, it must be something really special if God is going to provide the fire. And as we see, as we take a look at the list of these, that we will see something special in each one of them. Now, before I start, let's play a little guessing game. How many of these can you think of in Scripture? Give it a few thoughts, a few minutes. How many places can you remember from your studies where God consumed the fire or consumed the sacrifice with his own fire? Okay, well, we're going to take a look at a bunch of these. In fact, all of them. We're going to find out that there's probably about six. And I'm not going to take them in the order, the same order that they appear in Scripture. We're jumping around a little bit because we wanted to preserve some for a little bit later. But let's start our first example. And this may be one that you're very familiar with. Elijah on Mount Carmel. And of course, our key text here is 1 Kings 18:38. Then the fire of Jehovah fell and consumed the burnt offering and the wood and the stones and the dust and licked up the water that was in the trench. Boy, I want to tell you, as far as God accepting this, this was profound. And not only the sacrifice, but everything about it. God manifest himself, manifest his acceptance of Elijah's sacrifice. Now, you remember the circumstances here. On Mount Carmel here, this was the challenges of God. This was Jehovah versus Baal. And you may remember that the Baal worshippers and whatnot, they had a long ritual to try to get Baal to come and consume the sacrifice, and Elijah didn't have very much at all. But this is really interesting because this shows that the event not only demonstrated God's acceptance of the worship and offering of Jehovah, but it showed the power and Godship of Jehovah. When you've got anything supernatural, what a witness that this is. Now, let's just take a moment to talk about the differences between the ritual that the Baal worshippers used and the ritual that the worshippers of Jehovah used. All right, with Baal. Oh, there was dancing, and they were cutting their skins. Blood was flowing, cryings. Very, very dramatic. And maybe I'll even say melodramatic. And in the preparation, they had the driest wood they could have, carefully piled so that the slightest ignition would do everything to make it burn. Well, that was their preparation. Well, now let's contrast the preparation that Elijah did. The preparation was soak the wood three times. And what was his ritual? A simple prayer. He prayed to God. And then instantly the fire came out of heaven. Here's a couple of slides from the photodrama of creation. Elijah and the priests of Baal and Baal and Elijah's sacrifice accepted. Wow, you can't think of anything more dramatic than that. Of course, what followed after that was very sad too. Maybe not sad from the standpoint of getting rid of false worshipers, but a lot of the priests of Baal died that day. They were put to death for false worship. Now, when we consider this whole thing, there's a couple of more gems here that are worthwhile considering. The time of Elijah's offering was about 3 p.m. in the afternoon at the time of the evening sacrifice under the law. Now, you may remember that under the law, there was a morning sacrifice and there was an evening sacrifice. And do you remember what the animal was that was sacrificed each time? Yep, you're right. It was the lamb. So a lamb was sacrificed about 9 in the morning, and a lamb was sacrificed about 3 in the afternoon. There's the morning and evening sacrifice. By the way, do you anything come to mind about that period of time from 9 to 3? Again, you've got it. This is the time that Jesus was on the cross, from 9 o'clock in the morning till 3 o'clock in the evening. I think all of this is part of the type that told us about Jesus' experiences. Well, this was also the time, as we mentioned, that Jesus died. And so when we see here that the time of Elijah's offering at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, we can't help but consider and make the connection between the time of Jesus' sacrifice as the ultimate of a sacrifice that's acceptable to God. Now, there's a few more gems that we can pull out from here, too. Now, you remember the water that was used? There was a trench that was made for the water, and it contained about 2 measures of seed. This is in 1 Corinthians 18:22. That's a volumetric measure of how large the trench was, and it all contained water. Again, everything was done here to show that when this was consumed, it wasn't an accident. It wasn't just a coincidence, but it was by the power of God. Now, when you think about symbols, you think about water. What does water represent? Well, water is a symbol of truth. How about the 2 measures of seed? Well, when we think of seed and we think of 2 seeds, we have to think about the seed of Abraham, which is depicted as the stars of heaven and the sand of the seashore. Now, what connection do we make with that? Well, we make the high calling, the connection, the spiritual life, the spiritual hope, and then we have the hope, the earthly hope of restitution for mankind. So these are very powerful symbols. Water and 2 measures of seed certainly makes us think about the 2 salvations which Jesus came to earth to provide by his death on the cross. Okay, how about example number 2? We're going to talk now about the consecration of the Aaronic priesthood. Now, this is found in Leviticus chapter 9, and I'm going to read chapter 9, or at least a verse out of chapter 9, but I want to provide a little bit of background for this. Now, you may remember that in Leviticus chapter 8, you have all of the details of the consecration of the Aaronic priesthood laid out. In other words, here was the plan. This was the written plan. Here's what we're going to do. Here's the sacrifices we're going to go through, and we're going to do this, that, and the other. Now, we get to Leviticus 9, and it is carried out. So that's one difference between the two. The one is the description of it, and the 2 is the actual carrying out of it. So when we read this in Leviticus 9, this is what happened when they were consecrating the priesthood. Leviticus 9:24. And there came forth fire from before Jehovah and consumed upon the altar the burnt offering and the fat. And when the people saw it, they shouted and fell on their faces. Wow, this had to be something very, very exciting to them, and maybe awesome, maybe a little bit fearful. I can't imagine what fire coming down out of heaven and consuming a sacrifice must have been. I would guess there was probably a tremendous roar as well, so that there was a sound involved, and all the people saw it. And that's important. We'll take a look at that a little bit further here. When you read the 9th chapter of Leviticus, you see many sacrifices made that day, a bullock, a goat, an ox, and a ram, but it was the burnt offering that Jehovah accepted. And that's important. Why? Why just the burnt offering? Why didn't he manifest his fire in some other way? Well, Leviticus chapter 9 is a record of the consecration of the priesthood, not just the priest. Sounds like maybe a little detail here, but it's important because it was the priesthood as a whole that would be a blessing to Israel for many, many years. And so they had to be fully convinced in their own mind that this priesthood was, in fact, the priesthood of Jehovah. And so the finality of this whole service here, God's miraculous acceptance of that priesthood, God shows that from this point forward, Aaron and his sons are the priesthood accepted by Jehovah. And even more importantly here, the fact that the people saw it all was intended as an unambiguous public demonstration of God's acceptance. Now, let's go back for a second and think about some antitypes in this case. Now, we know that the priesthood of Aaron and his sons, of the high priest and the under priests, doing their sacrifice day by day, was a picture of the gospel age. You remember, we studied this in Leviticus chapter 16 on the Day of Atonement. The Day of Atonement sacrifices represent the sacrifices of the gospel age. So now, at the end of the gospel age, what will be Jehovah's indication of acceptance of the priesthood and the church? Remember, he showed it when it was accepted there in Leviticus 9. Now, how about there? Well, we have a clue from the Day of Atonement activities. And we're going to go here to Numbers chapter. Well, we're not going to go there yet. I'm going to ask you, what is the first sacrifice subsequent to the Day of Atonement sacrifices that was offered? Now, we have a chapter in Tabernacle Shadows about subsequent sacrifices subsequent to the Day of Atonement. But what was that very, what's the very first thing that was done? Well, the answer is given to us in Numbers chapter 29, verses 7 through 11. And ye shall have on the 10th day of this seventh month, notice that's the same day of the Day of Atonement, and holy convocation, and ye shall afflict your souls. Ye shall not do any work therein, but ye shall offer a burnt offering unto the Lord for a sweet savor. And one young bullock, one ram, and seven lambs, they shall be without blemish. Now, what does a bullock represent? Now, you might say, well, I remember from Tabernacle Shadows that it represents a perfect human being. And we saw that in the Day of Atonement sacrifices. Remember, there was a bullock and there was the Lord's goat. The bullock represented Jesus, wherein lies all of the merit. So it represents a perfect human being. But here in the context of Numbers 29, it can't represent Jesus in the church because this is right after the Atonement Day sacrifices that happened earlier. This is the beginning of the sacrifices subsequent to those. It was on the same Day of Atonement, but it was still subsequent. So it's got to represent something else. Well, let's ask this question. What happens after Christ and the church complete their antitypical day sacrifices? All right, we're looking at a day not too far in the future now where the church completes their sacrifice. All of the spirit begotten now are gone and beyond the veil. What's the first thing that happens when that becomes true? Think about it for a moment. If you say the new covenant is inaugurated, you're exactly right. The new covenant now can come into existence because the sacrificing is done. Well, when the new covenant is inaugurated, what happens next? Well, I think you would agree that the ancient worthies are raised to life. And maybe you're running a little bit ahead of me here, and that's good. Because the ancient worthies, when they're raised to life, they're going to be raised as perfect human beings. So how appropriate is it that after the Day of Atonement sacrifices are done, the very first burnt offering that's recognized there is a bullock, representative of the ancient worthies? Remember, the ancient worthies, they will come back as perfect human beings. And Moses passed away or died when he was 120. He's not coming back as a 120-year-old man. He and Abraham and Isaac and all of the men and women who are ancient worthies are going to come back as perfect human beings. And here's the point of all of this. This will be astonishing to the world. It will be what all of the people see. And they will recognize by the presence of the ancient worthies that God has accepted the priesthood of the glorified Christ. All right, we have to pick up speed a little bit here. I'm behind where I want to be. Example number three, King David. And this is in 1 Chronicles 21, 26. And David built there an altar unto Jehovah and offered burnt offerings and peace offerings and called upon Jehovah. And he answered him from heaven by fire upon the altar of burnt offering. Well, let's give a little background here because we want to set this in a series of events so you can understand what's happening. You may remember that in 1 Chronicles chapter 13, that David tried to bring the Ark of the Covenant back up to Jerusalem, but he put it in a wagon rather than the Levites carrying it, and it rocked a little bit, and Uzzah tried to steady it, and he was slain by the Lord. So kind of a not something too good here that happened right off, and David was a little bit discouraged. But he had success the second time when he brought into the ark with much rejoicing, and this is found in 1 Chronicles 15 and 16. So now we've got the Ark of the Covenant. Things are going well, and we can't help but expect good things to follow. Well, something unfortunately raises its head. In 1 Chronicles 21, again, notice that we're going through 1 Chronicles here. David was influenced by Satan in taking a census of the people. Now, how did Satan do that? Did he appeal to David's pride a little bit? We suspect that was so. But anyway, it was a sin, and Jehovah took displeasure in it, and then the result was that God brought a plague upon the people, and because of David's sin, 70,000 died from this plague. And God finally stopped the angel of judgment at the threshing floor of Onan. And David was told by the Lord to set up an altar there. All right, so let's just think about this for a moment. Here's a painting depicting this. You can see the avenging angel here up in the clouds, and you see Ornan, and you see David there. Let's read from 1 Chronicles 21, 20 through 22. And Ornan turned back and saw the angel and his four sons that were with him had hid themselves. Now, Ornan was threshing wheat. And as David came to Ornan, Ornan looked and saw David and went out to the threshing floor and bowed himself to David with his face to the ground. And David said to Ornan, give me the place of the threshing floor that I may build build thereupon an altar. And for the full price thou shalt give it to me, that the plague may be stayed from the people. So this is where Jehovah indicated he wanted an altar built. And so David went out and dutifully tried to do that. Now, you may remember that the threshing floor of Ornan was on a familiar place on Mount Moriah. Here is a article or a map showing it there, the location, just a little bit north of David's palace. Let's read a little bit more here of what happens. And by this way, this picture is a little bit better because it shows Ornan bowing to the earth, as the scripture says it would. But reading a little bit further here, verses 23 through 25. And Ornan said unto David, take it to thee, let my lord the king do that which is good in his eyes. Oh, I give thee the oxen for burnt offering, and the threshing instruments for wood, and the wheat for the meal offering. I give it all. And King David said to Ornan, nay, but I will verily buy it for the full price, for I will not take that which is thine for Jehovah, nor offer a burnt offering without cost. So David gave to Ornan for the place 600 shekels of gold by weight. And so he does that. And verse 26 says that he builds an altar. And we had read that earlier. And he answered from heaven by fire upon the altar for the burnt offering. So here is another case where Jehovah accepts the offering with his own fire. Now, Jehovah manifests his acceptance basically for two reasons. Number one, Jehovah accepted David's repentance. David was really sorry. I mean, I can't imagine the guilt he must have felt for tens of thousands of his compatriots being killed by it. It was his fault. But the second thing here is the most important. Jehovah accepted this place as the place of acceptable sacrifice. This second reason had profound significance. Of all the places on this earth, this location is special. Why? Well, it's the location where Abraham offered Isaac. Remember, on the mountains of Moriah. This is where Abraham was many generations previous. It's also the place where Solomon's temple would be built, 1 Chronicles 23. But most importantly, this is the location where Jesus was crucified. Now, we're not necessarily suggesting that all of them happened in the exact same spot, but they happened on Moriah. That was the common place, the commonality of all of these. And that is certainly stupendous. So we can understand why Jehovah chose to accept and consume this burnt offering with his own fire. All right, one application note here, and I like the way that Brother Jim Parkinson this morning made so many applications to our consecrated lives. You remember, David would not accept Ornan's offer to give it to him. He said he would not offer to God what does not cost him anything. Brethren, the lesson for us. We are not to offer to the Lord that which costs us nothing. Our life of sacrifice should always cost us something. And if we find a day go by where our consecration isn't costing us anything, perhaps we need to look more closely on how we might deepen that consecration and improve our service. All right, example number four, King Solomon. And this is in 2 Chronicles 7:1. And you may remember that this is the time now of the consecration of the temple that Solomon had just built. We read, now when Solomon had made an end of praying, the fire came down from heaven and consumed the burnt offering, and the sacrifices and the glory of Jehovah filled the house. Now remember that this is the very same place where the fire in the previous generation with David had come down on the threshing field of Ornan. So now we have father and son both experiencing this. Again, another indicator that this place is very, very special. And we have some nice, again, slides from the photo drama of creation. Here is Solomon offering a prayer of consecration to be followed by the fire of Jehovah. And what does it all mean? Well, very simply, the temple was accepted by Jehovah as an acceptable place of worship. And that temple, dear brethren, is a symbol of you and I. We are the spiritual temple. Here's a thought from reprint 5313. The church will be the great temple through which all the world of mankind may have access to God and return to harmony with him. Thus, eventually, this glorified church or temple will be the house of prayer for all people, all nations. Not that they will pray to a house, but they will approach God through the glorified church in which his presence will be manifested and his mercy will be available to all. From this viewpoint, the temple with its Shekinah glory represented the church in the glory of the future in association with Christ. And God will dwell in and operate through that glorious church for the blessings of the world. Here's one more little note. When you read the consecration of Solomon's temple, you find the number of sacrificed animals was 142,000. You know, when I was counting them all up and thinking, oh, could we have 144,000 here? I was disappointed that we didn't. And maybe somewhere along the line, there was another 2,000. Certainly comes very, very close to the number of the church. But the point here is that there were so many of them, they couldn't fit all on the altar. So Solomon sanctified the court and offered many more sacrifices there. This sort of suggests to our mind that God will accept sacrifices in the court as well as the altar. As the pastor wrote, it is always an acceptable time to consecrate, and there's no special place of consecration. You can be anywhere at any time. And of course, in the kingdom, the mankind will be expected to make a consecration as well. All right, moving on, we have the next example here of Gideon. This is example 5. And our text that describes this supernatural fire is in Judges chapter 6, verse 21. Then the angel of Jehovah put forth the end of the staff that was in his hand and touched the flesh and the unleavened cakes. And there went up a fire out of the rock and consumed the flesh and the unleavened cakes. And the angel of Jehovah departed out of his sight. We have to give a little background here as well. All this can be found in Judges chapter 6. But this was a time of great oppression of the Israelites. The Midianites were the ruling body there, and they were severely dominating Israel. They took everything, all the food that they made, they just took everything, and they were a great trial for the people. And so the people cried out to Jehovah for deliverance, and Jehovah chose Gideon to be the deliverer. And this little picture here just shows the fear that the Israelites had of the Midianites. Well, in Judges chapter 6, verse 11, we have a little bit of a description of that scene. And the angel of Jehovah came and sat under the oak, which was in Ophrah, and that pertained unto Joash the Abiezrite, and his son Gideon was beating wheat in the winepress to hide it from the Midianites. Remember, we mentioned they were taking everything. A winepress is a depression in the ground. So Gideon's down there threshing the wheat so that he won't be seen by the Midianites. Verses 17 and 18, and he said unto him, now this is Gideon speaking to the angel, if now I have found favor in thy sight, then show me a sign that it is thou that talkest with me. Depart not hence, I pray thee, until I come before thee and bring forth my present and lay it before thee. And he said again, this is the angel now, I will tarry until thou come again. So Gideon acknowledged that he'd been called, but he's still got some uncertainty here. He wants to make sure, he's looking for a sign. But he also wants to bring a present. He wants to be hospitable to this representative God. Present or a gift, several translations call this an offering. So he wants to bring an offering. That brings us to verse 19. And Gideon went in and made ready a kid and unleavened cakes of an ephah of the meal. The flesh he put into a basket, put the broth in a pot and brought it to him under the oak and presented this. Well, it sounds like a pretty good meal to me. I don't know. But anyway, this is what he brought out. Verse 20, the angel of God said unto him, take the flesh and the unleavened cakes and lay them upon the altar and pour out the broth. And he did so. You know, pouring out the broth on it sort of reminds us of the water on the sacrifice of Elijah, doesn't it? Well, what happened then? Verse 21. Then the angel of Jehovah put forth the end of his staff that was in his hand and touched the flesh and the unleavened cakes. And there went up a fire out of the rock and consumed the flesh and the unleavened cakes. And the angel of Jehovah departed out of his sight. Well, again, that must have been very, very interesting as well. It's curious that this fire came up from the rock rather than down from the heaven, but nevertheless, it was still supernatural fire, and it represented that God was accepting this sacrifice. So the consumption of the altar shows that Jehovah not only fully accepted what Gideon had brought, but it was the sign that Gideon was looking to or looking for, that now that he was fully authorized as God's agent to deliver Israel from the Midianites. So again, do you notice the commonality here? In every case, when we have this fire, it shows God's acceptance and authorization of what would go and come next. Now, let's go to our sixth example, Abel. Now, this one might be a little puzzling. It's a little bit of a conjecture, but assuming our surmise is right, we see the same elements of God's acceptance that we have seen in other examples as well. So we're talking about the offering of Abel in contradistinction to the offering of Cain. Let's read Genesis 4, 3 through 5. And in process of time, it came to pass that Cain brought of the fruit of the ground an offering unto Jehovah. And Abel, he also brought of the firstlings of his flock and of the fat thereof. And Jehovah had respect unto Abel and his offering, but unto Cain and to his offering he had not respect. And Cain was very wroth, and his countenance fell. So here's the question. How is it that Jehovah had respect for Abel's offering? What did he do? I mean, it's reasonable to believe that Jehovah showed his acceptance of Abel's offering in some visible way. How else could Abel have known that it was accepted? The suggestion of divine fire, therefore, is not an unreasonable one. And considering what we've already seen in the previous examples, that Jehovah demonstrated his acceptance of offering by supernatural fire, such an explanation here is very consistent. So again, we have the same lesson. In the case of Abel, we've provided an example of how Jehovah accepts or demonstrates his acceptance of offerings. Let me take just a little bit of a detour here and take up the question of blood versus bloodless sacrifices. You know, we've often asked or heard the question asked, well, why was Abel's sacrifice accepted and Cain's wasn't? And one of the answers is, well, his was a bloodless sacrifice. It was vegetables, and Jehovah wanted a blood sacrifice. Well, that may be true, but it is also true that under the law, bloodless sacrifices were quite accepted. Here's an example, Leviticus chapter 2, verse 1. And when anyone offereth an oblation of a meal offering unto Jehovah, the oblation shall be a fine flour, and he shall pour oil upon it and put frankincense thereon, and he shall bring it to Aaron's sons, the priests, and he shall take thereout a handful of fine flour thereof and the oil thereof with all the frankincense thereof, and the priest shall burn it as a memorial there upon the altar, an offering made by fire of sweet savor unto Jehovah. And that which is left of the meal offering shall be Aaron's and his sons. It is a thing most holy of the offerings, of offerings of Jehovah made by fire. So not only was this bloodless offering accepted, we are told specifically it's a sweet savor. I mean, going back, Jehovah appreciated the heart intent from the offer. So we can't really make a blanket statement that because Cain's offering didn't have any blood, that's why it wasn't accepted. However, there is something to this, and we should pursue this just a little bit more. We just can't leave it at that. In Hebrews chapter 11, verse 4, we read this. By faith, Abel offered unto God a more excellent sacrifice than Cain, through which he had witness borne to him that he was righteous, God bearing witness in respect to his gifts, and through it, he being dead yet speaketh. Now, notice a couple of things here. That by faith, Abel offered unto God a more excellent sacrifice. So in some way, the blood sacrifice was more excellent than the vegetable sacrifice. How so? We're told by faith. Well, what faith? Why did Abel choose to do this? In fact, how did Abel know that Jehovah would even accept a sacrifice of his animals? Well, we don't have the answer to that, but we do know that when Jehovah was speaking to Cain about it, that he had conversation with Jehovah. Could it be that Abel asked Jehovah, I want to make a sacrifice to you. What can I do? And maybe it was Jehovah, at least through his angels, that said, offer one of your flock. And by faith, he was able to do that. Now, one more connection here that maybe again is suggestive that indeed a blood sacrifice is in fact what God wanted. In Genesis 4:7, now this is Jehovah through his angel speaking to Cain. If thou doest well, shall it not be lifted up? And if thou doest not well, sin crouches at the door, and unto thee shall be its desire, but do thou rule over it. Well, this is certainly a little hard to understand. But remember, Cain was not doing well. He was an evil person. He was a wicked person. Paul tells us that that's the case. But he says sin crouches at the door. When I was looking at the word for word in a Hebrew interlinear, I noticed something interesting. You see the word here for sin, chitath? In the interlinear, it says sin offering. I thought, that's odd. What does that mean? Sin offering. Well, let's put it in there. A sin offering croucheth at the door. Could it be, and I'm not sure of this, I'm just making it as a suggestion, that Jehovah's telling Cain that, you know, your sacrifices haven't been accepted, but there's a sin offering over there, crouching at the door. It belongs to your brother. Maybe you should do a little trade and get it from him. Brethren, this is just a suggestion, but I thought it was very interesting that the word for sin offering and sin is the exact same word used throughout the scriptures in connection with this. All right, we've done six so far, and we've seen in every case, assuming our surmise about Cain is right, that God shows his acceptance by supernatural fire. He did it in unusual or extraordinary circumstances where that demonstration of divine power and acceptance was important. So we're going to go on to a seventh example. What might that be? Well, brethren, I'm going to suggest it is you and me. How so? Well, again, we've seen several examples of how Jehovah God manifests his acceptance of sacrifices by supernatural. He did it in extraordinary times. In each case, there was a special lesson to be learned. Brethren, all of us are in the process of offering to Jehovah our consecrated lives. We did that initially at the beginning. We followed the outline in Romans chapter 12, verse 1, and we offered a sacrifice of our living bodies, and it was accepted. But now we continue to live out that offering and to re-offer every day in our daily lives. But it's a question I think all of us who are consecrated ask. How do we know that Jehovah has accepted our offering? How do we know that he's accepting our offering day by day? That's an important question. But remember the principle we've been demonstrating so far in our examples. Jehovah accepts offering by consuming them with divine fire. Brethren, it is no different from us. He accepts our offering by consuming our sacrifice. And here's a beautiful text of scripture. A little bit of a prayer, Psalm 20, verse 3. Remember all thy offerings and accept thy burnt sacrifice, Selah. This is a prayer asking that it might be accepted, and it's our prayer too. But we have another rendering of this text which is very enlightening, and this is from Young's literal translation. Notice how he puts it. He doth remember all thy presents, and thy burnt offering doth reduce to ashes. You see, that's the indicator of God's acceptance, that he reduces your offering to ashes. Here's a little quote from Barnes' notes on this very text of scripture on this very point. Quote, and accept, margin, turn to ashes or make fat. The Hebrew word, dashan, means properly to make fat or marrowy. Proverbs 15:30, to pronounce or regard as fat, to be fat or satiated or abundantly satisfied. Proverbs 13:4. It conveys the notion of reducing to ashes, perhaps from the fact that the victim, which had been fattened for sacrifice, was reduced to ashes, or as Jacinius supposes, because ashes were used here by the ancients for fattening, that is, manuring the soil. The prayer here seems to be that God would pronounce the burnt offering fat. That is, he would regard it favorably or would accept it. Again, this is from Barnes' notes. So Jehovah manifests his acceptance of our offering by turning it to ashes. Brethren, he shows his acceptance of us by using us. He turns our sacrifice into ashes, lifting up the sacrifice. Now for us, in order to be turned into ashes requires constant contact with the fire. We can't back off because it's hot. Of Jesus, as it was said, the zeal in thine house hath consumed me. Is Jehovah using you? If you are laying down your lives daily in the service of Jehovah, the truth and the brethren, and are being a blessing in so doing, then God is using you. He is turning your offering to ashes and shows his acceptance of your offering. So the seventh fire, dear friends, from heaven is the acceptance of your own consecration. As Jehovah uses you in his service, he is accepting you and he is consuming you. We must have a burning desire to give to Jehovah what we have promised him. Brother John Eger said this, daily seek to renew your consecration and daily seek to fulfill it. Dear brethren, may we labor without ceasing in the service of Jehovah through Jesus Christ, making an offering of our small service in the hope that Jehovah will accept it and turn it to ashes. And out of those ashes, may we hope for a beautiful crown of glory, the final acceptance of our offering, and the proclamation from God, well done, my good and faithful service. I close with these wonderful words from Isaiah chapter 60, verses 1 through 3. The Spirit of the Sovereign Lord is on me, because the Lord hath anointed me to proclaim good news to the poor. He has sent me to bind up the brokenhearted, to proclaim freedom for the captives and release from darkness for the prisoners, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor and the day of vengeance of our God, to comfort all who mourn and provide for those who grieve in Zion, to bestow upon them the oil of joy instead of mourning, a crown of beauty instead of ashes, and a garment of praise instead of the spirit of despair. They will be called oaks of righteousness, a planting of the Lord for the display of his splendor. Dear brethren, may the Lord bless this to you.